Well, good morning. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Elliot Callan. I am CEO of Prosperity Financial Group, and I would like to welcome you to another episode of Meet the Expert. Very exciting. This is something we don't do a lot of, but we have a real expert on about Bitcoin and blockchain and what is this? And that's gone from 50-something thousand, $60-something thousand dollars a coin to $20,000. And should we buy it? Is it going bankrupt? Is it the future? Is it the past? Lots of great questions. If you need to reach me, I'm at 925-314-8503. That's my direct line. It's Elliot, E-L-L-I-O-T, at prosperityfinancialgroup.com. And we're at www.prosperityfinancialgroup.com. And you can make an appointment using my Calendly that's on the website. So let me welcome Ben McMillan. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you, Elliot. Great to be here.
Just thank you. And great to have you. Just a quick introduction. Ben, and I'll make it fast because people want to hear what you have to say rather than who you are. And that is that he's got great credentials. He's founder of IDX. That's obviously the company that specializes in Bitcoin. A lot of credentials after his name and masters and so forth. He's been on Bloomberg. He's been on Fox Business. He's been on CNBC. I don't even know what other shows you've been on. Maybe you've been on Oprah. I don't know what other shows you've been on. But you truly are an expert in what some perceive as the future of exchangeable currency out there. So why don't we start some basic things, if that's all right with you, Ben. How does Bitcoin, what is it? How does it work? How does the average person get hold of it? And then the volatility, let's talk about that too. So let me turn it over to you for a moment, and I might interrupt you with more questions.
By all means, absolutely. So the kind of the simplest way to think about, you know, Bitcoin or blockchain technology in general is just a decentralized network of computers. So the question is, all right, what's so great about that? You know, there's a lot of nice properties to that. So if you think about, you know, Google Cloud or Amazon AWS, you know, the ability to have computing capability that's decentralized, so it's, you know, tens of thousands of computers all over the globe, you know, that can send transactions back and forth is nice because it's very robust. It's very durable. You know, one of the reasons, you know, a lot of people in recent years have gotten excited about blockchain technology is, you know, when there's been other events where centralized services have gone down, blockchain-based technology has stayed up. And so, you know, it started, you know, as kind of among early adopters in technology that first, you know, saw the promise of this technology, it started to now go mainstream. Now, a large part of that is because of the financial component too. You know, Bitcoin, of course, was early on in being seen by, you know, by many as, a competition for money or currency. And so that brought in a wave of kind of, you know, speculative buying. But it is important to, you know, detach the underlying fundamentals from, you know, the speculative price behavior, much in the same way that commodities, you know, there's intrinsic value into, you know, for wheat or copper, you know, oil, but, you know, the price at any one time can be excessively volatile. So you've got kind of, you know, two competing camps here. So, you know, Bitcoin, I'll wrap that thought by saying a good way to think about it is really kind of the 90s era. You know, for those of us that remember that, you know, the idea of the internet was still in its nascency in kind of the early 90s, mid 90s. And then we had the dot-com bubble where, you know, any business with a dot-com at the end of it, you know, went to the moon. We had the dot-com bust when, you know, people realized that just putting a dot-com at the end of a bad business doesn't make it a better business. You know, pets.com was still a bad business model. You know, and so everything got, you know, the baby got thrown out with the bathwater, so to speak. And, you know, now that's kind of what, you know, crypto in general has been going through very recently with, you know, this kind of boom and then bust is, you know, the speculative, you know, excess working its way to a fever pitch. You know, now the baby's coming out the bathwater, and people are going back to the roots and looking at the technology and, you know, starting to build from there. So anyway, that's, you know, at a high level, that's why people are getting excited about Bitcoin. That's why, you know, a lot of, you know, kind of technology focus groups and, you know, bigger players are starting to look at this as a better way to send, you know, payments internationally, you know, a better way to, you know, run decentralized services, even things as complicated as exchanges or banking functions can be done in a decentralized way, which has a lot of nice properties to it. So it's an area of excitement, but again, as I said, it's one where it's seen kind of speculative excesses.
So just on that note, if we could, before we get into good use of it, there are some companies that aren't going to survive, and And by the way, we're talking with Ben McMullen, and you've got an interesting degree, econometrics from the London School of London School of Economics, as my son has been, was there too. So I have great respect for these think
tanks. Oh, excellent. Yeah.
Yeah, a bunch of MIT geeks there now in London, all studying on how to change the world. But it gives you a lot of gravitas on the subject, and that's why I brought that up. But looks like Coinbase may go out of business. Other exchanges, Ethereum, are they going to survive? There's Doge that was created as a joke. We've seen Elon Musk kind of use it as a joke and things like that. So there's a lot of fat in the market. How do you understand that?
That's a good way to put it. And again, this goes back. That's why I like the .com analogy so much, is because, you know, you look back to that era and you had, you know, good companies like Amazon.com, you know, right alongside, like I said, Pets.com. And that's what we've got now. Now the tide, you know, this tide is going out. The Fed obviously is pulling back on liquidity. That makes capital much more discerning, you know, not just within the crypto spectrum, but everywhere, you know, high value growth stocks. I mean, you look at, you know, the ARK ETF is down big year to date, because again, all of a sudden capital is starting to be more discerning in terms of where it's going to place its bet. Growth is getting repriced. And so, you know, within the crypto market, yeah, that's absolutely right. There's a lot of companies that are not going to make it. I think, you know, things like Coinbase and some of the bigger ones are, you know, they're big enough and they have a big enough footprint that I'd be hard pressed to believe they go out of business in the same way that Lehman Brothers did. You know, there's probably some big strategic out there that would prevent that from happening. But groups like Celsius, I mean, that's been in the news recently. You know, Luna, to back up about a month, you know, when we started seeing kind of the real stresses in the crypto market unfold, there was a protocol called Luna, which was its own blockchain. And it was poorly constructed from the beginning. It was one that, you know, had a lot of criticisms early on. Some of the behaviors by the founders were, you know, very kind of scammy or seemed scammy. You know, a lot of people, you know, were worried that it was kind of a glorified pump and dump. And, you know, that was a project that, you know, raised a ton of money, did well as long as the, you know, music was playing, so to speak. But as soon as the Fed started pulling liquidity out of the market, you know, it was a house of cards that just collapsed in on itself. And so, you know, that was one that was, you know, an outright, you know, if it wasn't an outright, it wasn't an outright Ponzi scheme, but it was structurally very similar. It required money to keep coming in to stay afloat. You know, fast forward now, we had Celsius most recently. It was a very big centralized company paying out 20% APR on crypto loans. So that's one where you could buy Bitcoin through them, and or Ethereum, and you could lend it out and they would pay 20%. Well, the way they were able to do that was they were borrowing, you know, VC money and just literally subsidizing that rate. Well, that's obviously not a sustainable business model. You know, that's one, again, when liquidity is cheap and easy, you can get away with it. And, you know, that was part of their play to kind of buy users. But once liquidity becomes more expensive, you know, that's a business model that goes to zero. And that's what we've been seeing. You know, they've been a stressed seller in the marketplace recently. And so, you know, they've needed to get a bailout, or they're looking for a bailout. So you're going to have companies like that do go to zero. But now on the other end of the spectrum, look at the, you know, the protocols themselves. So, you know, Coinbase, Celsius, you know, these are centralized companies. They're not decentralized protocols. They're in the crypto market, but they're regulated and you know, they have a PO box and all of that. When you look at something like Ethereum or Bitcoin, you know, those are actual just blockchains. And so there's no centralized company that quote unquote owns that. It's purely decentralized. And so that's a lot more durable. That's a lot more robust. That doesn't mean that the price can't get too high. And again, that's what we've seen. The market is, you know, repricing Bitcoin, but it does mean that it can't be, you know, regulated out of business or out of existence. So there's a durability component there that's appealing. And that's one of the reasons, you know, people have kind of rallied around the idea of decentralized blockchain technologies, is because you don't have to worry about that counterparty risk that you might with a Coinbase or a Celsius or you know, even an IDX or whatever, no matter who it is. So that's a key distinction.
Okay, so this is confusing, and it's high level stuff that we're talking to clients and potential clients on, and you know, and friends. So I want to get back to regulation, and I want to talk about afterwards the dollar. But let's talk for a moment about supply chain versus blockchain. We have a major supply chain issue around the world. I don't know if that goes away unless we have a worldwide recession. Maybe we're going to have that. Who knows? But there are a lot of people who think that the answer to the worldwide supply chain problem is locked up a little bit in Bitcoin, that they can solve this. So tell me about that.
I think blockchain technology can absolutely help. You know, whether it can solve it in one fell swoop, you know, it's unlikely. Supply chain issues are highly complicated, you know, not the least of which is, you know, competing kind of political considerations that are, you know, completely exogenous. You know, a unilaterally declared war, for example, in the middle of Europe isn't, you know, Bitcoin isn't going to solve for that. But where it can solve, and where you've seen some of the early work on blockchain technologies by some big name companies, by the way, is in logistics and supply chain. And again, you know, if you think about being able to just at the simplest level, being able to cut out the middlemen. You know, if you look right now with supply chains, you know, one of the things that's like the old, actually, this was on one of my game theory exams at the London School of Economics is, you know, how do traffic jams happen? And, you know, it's game theory where if, you know, one person slows down the road to see what's happening in the other lane, that has ripple effects that are, you know, amplified. So that's how you get, you know, 10-mile traffic jams when just one person is stopping for a split second at a time. Supply chain logistics is very much the same way. You know, you've got a lot of different interconnected links. And if just one of them jams up, that jams up the next one and it's an exponential effect. Well, if you can automate a lot of that and remove the human component, or embed that in self-executing smart contracts, which is what blockchain technology does, you can remove a lot of the middleman layer and really kind of streamline different supply chains. Now that there's a lot to be built out there, but the key is that it is being built. You know, one of the big things we always get the question, you know, how do you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum aren't zeros, they're worthless, they don't do anything. You know, everything is theoretical. And the answer is, well, you know, 10 years ago, this was all theoretical. And I remember buying Bitcoin 10 years ago. I remember mining Bitcoin 10 years ago. And it was, you know, everything I'm talking about now back then was very much a theoretical use case. It was a could happen or might happen. You know, now fast forward, and it's really been the last kind of 24 to 36 months, 2 to 3 years, we're seeing applications, you know, start to solve this. Now there's a long way to go. It's not going to solve supply chain issues, you know, this year, but it is being developed. And so that's a key consideration as it relates to, you know, kind of blockchain or Bitcoin and Ethereum, is that the use cases now are no longer purely academic. They're being built. They're being built and deployed in the real world. And, you know, you're seeing companies actually start to, you know, deploy them. Disney, for example, is using a blockchain called Stellar for some early, you know, logistics exercises. You know, IBM has a deal with Stellar for something similar. And so you're starting to see big companies turn to this, and it's not for marketing, you know, purposes. It's because, you know, they've got problems they want to solve. I think to answer your question, I think blockchain technology will absolutely help the supply chain issue. It's going to take time. It's got to be built. It's not going to be, you know, a one and done answer, but I think it is, you know, much in the same way that, you know, back in the early 90s, it wasn't yet clear how the internet was going to affect all of our lives. Now, of course, fast forward, you know, 20 or 30 years and it's ubiquitous. We can't imagine life without it. You know, we could very well see a similar progression with blockchain technology.
So there are some people on that same blockchain technology concept who the prognosticators of the world that say, when we get rid of the middleman, you're eliminating the need for Google and all these servers out in the marketplace, because computers will talk directly to computers. And it's hard to imagine a world without a Google or Microsoft. There are all these millions of servers talking to each other. How do you see it?
Well, I think it's probably going to be a hybrid, you know, and this is the big, if you've heard the term Web3, you know, that's what they're referring to, is basically a decentralized, you know, internet, you know, one in which the, you know, the Googles, you know, would be, you know, disintermediated by a global network of peer-to-peer computers. I don't think it's a one or the other. I think we're going to have hybrid approaches. You know, there are a lot of benefits to decentralized blockchains, but there are some drawbacks. And so there is a place for both. You know, there some of the benefits of centralized servers, you know, centralized computers, are speed and scalability. You sacrifice on the security, and you sacrifice on the kind of other pieces of the puzzle. But I think it's inevitable that blockchain technology starts to take away some market share from the Googles of the world over time. And that's, you know, you've seen the idea too, and you'll see more of this. Like I said, the Web 3.0 concept, one of the kind of strong pillars of that thought is, people owning their own data. You know, one of the big issues, you know, with privacy rights recently has been, you know, these big companies, you know, Google and Facebook, you know, they actually own our data, they monetize our data, and the consumer has no say in that. So one of the big promises of the a decentralized internet, what they're calling Web 3.0, is that users can own their data. And so it wouldn't be in the hands of any centralized entity, it would be in the hands of the users. And we could choose, you know, who sees our data, how we want to monetize it. And so, you know, I think it's going to be a hybrid world. There's going to be a place for both. But I don't see any state of the world in which, you know, Web3 or blockchain doesn't take, you know, some market share from the Googles and the Facebooks of the world, which is why you're starting to see these guys, you know, make a land grab in the blockchain space. I mean, Facebook renamed their name to Meta, for example, to make a metaverse play. I mean, they, you know, these guys are smart. They see where the puck is going, and, you know, they're trying to skate there, you know, before everybody else. So.
Well, I like the hockey metaphor. We're talking with Ben McMullen of IDX. He's the founder of IDX. We'll get to that in a moment. If you want to reach me, I'm at 925-314-8503. And Elliot, E-L-L-I-O-T, at prosperityfinancialgroup.com or www.prosperityfinancialgroup.com. So let's keep going, Ben, if we could. We have a few more minutes here still. Let me talk about the dollar. The competition from the dollar. So I look at this and I have been wondering, as somebody who's been in a financial advisory business for 29 years, almost 30 years now, giving people advice on money and investments and retirement, that I'm wondering why the US Treasury has allowed Bitcoin to even exist and get to the point that it's come to, and why they haven't come up with their own version of the crypto dollar. Because you and I both know that China has aspirations for taking out the world and being the only world player. And so in crypto, they want to have the only world currency. And you know they have trillions of dollars in their currency, but trillions of dollars that can make a difference. And they've got a navy and other places that can make a difference on there. So let's talk about competition from the US dollar. Is it real competition? Are we going to have a cryptocurrency? How does that work with Bitcoin? Does that clear the space even more from and gets rid of other currencies too?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, I think that's exactly right that, you know, the Fed originally looked at this, or the, you know, the regulators in general originally looked at this. They didn't like it. They didn't want competition. But again, because it's decentralized, they can't take it down. And so they quickly realized, they saw what China was doing, and they quickly realized that, you know, we gotta come up with our own, you know, central bank digital currency to stay relevant. And I look at, you know, Chairman Powell's comments this past Friday, I think were very telling. And this didn't get a lot of play on the media, but he said at a banking conference that, you know, the US needs to have a central bank digital currency for the dollar to maintain its preeminence. So he's already looking at kind of a post-dollar world. You know, I don't think it's any surprise that, you know, the Middle Eastern country, Saudi Arabia, is now starting to negotiate, you know, potentially moving away from a dollar denominated oil. You know, so, you know, the US regulators are looking at this and saying, you know, the digital currencies are here to stay. We can't get rid of them as much as we would like. China's already beat us to the punch in launching their CBDC. Saudi Arabia is about to move away from, you know, dollar denominated oil. We need to get in this game. It's not unlike Facebook. You know, they had a great moat for a while. Blockchain currencies is going to, you know, take that away. And so that, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. So I think we'll see. I think we'll certainly see a central bank digital currency. The question is when. I think it's probably sooner than later. You know, the Fed has had a pilot project with MIT for several years now in terms of developing blockchain technology. It's totally public. It has not been well advertised. That may or may not be by design, but you can go and Google it. You can see the papers. I mean, they've done a lot of work in terms of developing a pilot for what a Fed coin or a CBDC would look like. I think that's only accelerated now. And I think Powell's comments on Friday, you know, kind of, you know, hint at that. I think that'll be good for, I think that there's kind of two schools of thought here. I think regulation around stablecoins in general is going to be good. I think a central bank digital currency will help that. It'll ultimately help increase adoption. It'll help be an on-ramp, a safe on-ramp, you know, for people that are nervous about crypto. They don't want market risk. So maybe they don't want Bitcoin or Ethereum, but they're skeptical of private currencies, which are, you know, all stable coins right now are technically private currencies. And so you've got to really, you know, trust that the peg maintains. If there could be a Fed coin, you know, that's backed by the full faith and credit of the US government, that could, I think, go a long way towards kind of increasing the audience for crypto, ultimately getting them, you know, on board. And then what does that do to Bitcoin and Ethereum and the existing cryptos? I think it sits alongside them. You know, I think there's going to be an exchange rate, just like there's an exchange rate now for US dollar and Bitcoin, or, you know, Russian ruble and Bitcoin, whatever it is. You know, there's going to be a digital version of the US dollar. That's this Fed coin. It just, you know, comes with it all the program, you know, programmatic aspects that, you know, people like. You know, just imagine getting your tax refund directly. You know, your tax refund could, in a pure blockchain world where all, you know, all your spending was captured, your tax refund can be as easy as, you know, just hitting your wallet. Or you look at stimulus payments, you know, you wouldn't have to put checks in the mail, that could just hit your wallet. So there's a lot of appeals to having kind of digital currency. And again, I think maintaining dollar hegemony as long as they can is one of the big ones.
And you think there's room if we do have a dollar and a Chinese currency there, you think there's room for Bitcoin too? People would actually say, I'm going to deal in a third party, but I have a sovereign Bitcoin, sovereign crypto.
Well, yeah, because Bitcoin is still going to have value independent of the Fed, you know, so the Fed coin is going to be, you know, the Fed isn't going to have a cryptocurrency that, you know, competes against Bitcoin or Ethereum, because they're just going to have a stable coin. And they're, you know, with it, it's going to be, you know, and, you know, there are concerns with that too. One of them is, you know, privacy rights. People have said with the Fed coin, you know, they can see exactly what you're doing, how you're spending. In fact, a lot of people don't know, but recently in China, during their zero COVID policy, they would lock down wallets that they thought were violating COVID policy based on where they were spending their e-renminbi. So if you were spending their digital coin at a place or a time you shouldn't be, they could just shut your wallet down. Whereas, you know, so a lot of with physical cash, you can't do that. So there are privacy concerns around central bank digital currencies. There's also inflation concerns. You know, the central bank digital currency, is going to inflate at the same rate the dollar is. So for people that are concerned about purchasing power and hyperinflation and things like that, you know, the central bank digital currency doesn't solve that. That's one of the appeals of, you know, these decentralized currencies, is that nobody can flip a switch and decide to, you know, make more Bitcoin. I mean, you know, there's a predetermined amount. There's only ever going to be 21 million in existence. And, you know, that is what it is. And as long as that blockchain has utility, owning a piece of that blockchain, you know, is going to have utility as well. And so I think you're going to start to see specialization. You're going to see certain blockchains optimized for certain things. Bitcoin is going to be one. Ethereum is going to be one. And then, you know, you're going to have this, the various central bank digital currencies, which are going to be just digital arms of those existing currencies. So I absolutely think there's a place for both. I think the race really is between the Fed coin and the other central bank digital currencies. So, you know, their race isn't necessarily against Bitcoin or Ethereum. It's against the China e-yuan.
So there are some professional ball players that decided they wanted to get paid in Bitcoin. So it wasn't too long ago that Bitcoin was over $60,000 a coin. And today it's 20, give or take, right? So if I've negotiated your contract at 60,000 market rate, which was at that time 60,000, and I'm paying you $5 million contract based on $60,000 a coin, and today it's worth 20, did I just get a 2/3 haircut?
Yes, you did. And that is why I reached out to every single one of those ball players. I reached out to the mayor of New York. I reached out to the mayor of Tampa, who also said she wanted to take her payment in Bitcoin. And I said, think twice about that. And if you do, take it in our risk managed Bitcoin fund, because it's going to preserve value during drawdowns. So yeah, it is something. I mean, people, you know, this has always been our issue is, you know, it's easy to get excited about blockchain technology, but also understand price is something different, and price is going to be all over the place. Is a speculative asset class where 50% drawdowns are a way of life. And, you know, I don't have to tell you that, you know, when you get into the math of drawdowns, anything, you know, 50% or above, you've got to make back, you know, you've got to double your money just to get back to break even. In fact, that's where we are right now. You know, the Bitcoin is down, you know, from all-time highs, Bitcoin is down well over 50%. So if you rode that down, you know, you need it to go, you know, back up, you know, at least 100% just to get back to break even. Where, you know, if you, for just, you know, for example, our, you know, risk managed approach is this year is down about 24%. So, you know, that's in line with 20-year bonds. So, you know, it doesn't need to, you don't have to spend as much time digging yourself back out. So we are firm believers in taking a risk managed approach, either, you know, a group like ours, dollar cost averaging, sizing it appropriately, whatever it might be, but be cognizant of the risks, because the price risks, because it could be a good technology, but it can also be very speculative. And again, this is like, you know, look at the ARK Innovation ETF. I mean, there's a lot of companies in there that are, you know, are probably, you know, way overpriced. But this, you know, they've got good, you know, they're good businesses. They're going to be around, but the price just got way ahead. And so that's, you know, that's why you've got it down 70%. So I think that was part of the learning curve for a lot of people, is realizing, you know, that Bitcoin was this kind of great shiny object that was going to, you know, disrupt the world. I want to only be paid in it. But, you know, they weren't around for the last crypto winter where, you know, prices were down, you know, 70-80%. So I think that's, yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, to answer your question, you know, those people that top ticked, you know, that just basically got themselves a, you know, a 70% pay cut.
So, and let's kind of end with that, if we could, one more question. So in your world, because we now have added the IDX product to moderate growth and growth portfolios between last week and this week, but people are scared because it's gone from 60 something thousand of Bitcoin to 20. That's down by, you know, 2/3 basically. But we're not riding that because you're taking limited risk. Explain that to the average person so they know that we're not just stocking up on something that might go down still another 50.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, we, you know, our approach is to be very respectful of the risk in this asset class. And so, you know, everything we do, it's all model driven. And what we're looking for is, we're looking for conviction buying momentum. And so, you know, if you go back to actually October of last year is when we started to see, you know, some waning conviction. And so we started raising cash, you know, raised more cash. You know, we've been entirely in cash, you know, for the last month now, kind of sitting out of the sidelines. And so, you know, the idea is, you know, we're not going to avoid all the drawdown, you know, like you've said, but, you know, but in this case, you know, since the all-time highs, Bitcoin's down, you know, 60 or 70%. We're down about, you know, 1/3 of that. And so the idea is if you can, you know, capture, you know, more than 50% of the upside and participate in less than 50% of the downside, you've got an asymmetric payoff. So you're getting, you know, you're getting more than half of the upside when it goes up, you're getting less than half the downside when it goes down. And over time, you get participation to the asset class, but it's going to be, it should be a smoother ride. It's expected to be, you know, your capital is expected to compound more efficiently. You know, the idea is that you're not going to have to endure these, you know, 50%+ drawdowns. You know, the volatility profile of our fund is expected to be, you know, something more in line with like commodities. So again, I don't want to give the impression that there's no volatility or that there's going to be no drawdowns, but you know, it shouldn't be, you know, 50, 60, 70% drawdowns. It should be, you know, 10, 20, 30% drawdowns.
I get it. And on your word that you used a phrase crypto winter, I've heard that on TV. What does that mean?
Crypto winter was, you know, just the kind of the dormancy period after the 2017 crypto boom. You know, 2018, you know, crypto was down 80, Bitcoin was down 80%, and it stayed there for a while. You know, back then, crypto was still relatively new. You didn't hear about it on CNBC. All these use cases I've talked about were still academic. Nothing really had been developed of note, or if it did, it wasn't getting scale yet. So I don't think it didn't have nearly the adoption we have now. You know, now we've got, you know, dozens, or not dozens, but we've got, you know, several, you know, Bitcoin ETFs, mutual funds. The institutional adoption is there. So I don't think we're in for a prolonged crypto winter like we were last time. But it's come to be known as kind of a moniker for the industry that when, you know, when crypto prices get down this much, you know, everybody starts screaming crypto winter again. So
just yesterday or the day before, I noticed that one of your competitors created an ETF that shorts Bitcoin.
Yeah. That's a tricky one. You know, we've had a lot of people that have been in our models, you know, from day one when we started opening it to outside capital in 2019. And so that they've seen them, you know, perform well. And they say, you know, can't you just invert your model? We want a short version. Shorting is very difficult. You know, in an asset class like this, where there's huge upside volatility, one of the things that's interesting about digital assets is that there's a lot of upside volatility. So that if that means, you know, it can rise 20% out of nowhere. And when you're shorting, you know, it's easy to look at an environment like this and say, wow, we could have made so much money if we'd been short instead of flat. But you've got to, you know, it's tricky at the turning points, because that's where, you know, these short only funds can erode a lot of capital. So yeah, there's a place for short Bitcoin ETFs, to be sure. but it's tricky. I wouldn't just, you know, if you're bearish on the asset class, I you know, it's like the VIX ETF, where, you know, it's the mechanics are a little bit detached from, you know, how the actual ETF performs. So yeah, it's a wild ride to be sure.
Well, we've been talking with Ben McMillan, and hopefully everybody understands this conversation. And if you didn't, play it again. It might take you two or three go-rounds on here. Super bright guy, one of the brighter guys on the street, London School of Economics, on econometrics. Great background, founder of IDX. If you need to reach me, I'm at 925-314-8503. And then I think by now you've got my email, and the website is www.prosperityfinancialgroup.com. There's a Calendly program to make an appointment. So Ben, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Elliot. It was great doing this.
Thank you so much. And don't hesitate giving us a call. And we look forward to seeing you again. Thank you.